it matters to you, let us know. Contact us now, 1850 400 964 or email focus@clare.fm.
Welcome back to the programme. 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. It's Morning Focus for Thursday morning. It's Pat Flynn sitting in for Gavin this week and next. 086 1800 964 is the text number as always if you want to get in touch with us. And I'm joined in studio this morning by Dr. Maura Finn from the Ennis Family Medical Centre. Maura, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
Good to see you. Very well, thank you. Let's start off with some questions that have been sent in to us by listeners. Man has an issue with which happens occasionally when he's sleeping. He wakes up and is unable to breathe. Is gasping for breath. It's like there is an airlock and it takes up to 3 minutes for him to be able to breathe normally, and he gets very panicked over it. Mm. That sounds a bit frightening, doesn't it?
Sounds very distressing, doesn't it? The most obvious explanation would be what we'd call sleep apnea, and we've talked about that before here. But it's when, especially if you have a little bit of weight on, when you're at sleep, what happens is you're kind of, the pressure around your throat increases a little. Now, it'll never choke you, it'll never actually make you pass out, but it makes you gag and it makes you fight for breath. And you'll have people, often it's actually the partners of somebody would actually notice this more. The person themselves might just kind of rouse themselves, kind of cough a little and then go back to sleep. But the partner might notice that the person has stopped breathing for a period of time. Now, it's probably only seconds, but it might seem like a long time. But they're making these unusual noises as well. And that's the most likely thing. It depends on when this happens with this person too. Is it when they're lying on their back? Is it when they're lying on their front? Obviously, if the person, if it's ever been witnessed, it'd be really important to kind of look at that in case it's something more sinister like a seizure. But
it's going
unlikely.
On a while, apparently. It's happened about 12 or 14 times over a 10-year period, maybe once or twice
a year
on average.
Okay, it's not sleep apnea would tend to be more common than that, to be honest. It may have been like something that happens during a very distressing dream as well. There are things that happen to people where they have a kind of a temporary, you actually have a paralysis when you're in a certain type of sleep. So that it stops you acting out your dreams, actually. That's one of the points of it, but that can actually, some people are very aware of it and they can wake up mid-paralysis and they feel like they can't do anything. It's very uncomfortable, very distressing symptom as well. So this may be a version of that, some sort of a sleep disturbance. In its most extreme form, it may even be a form of seizure. I think that's unlikely because it's happening so rarely, thank God. But if it's he's very distressed, I'd suggest he have sleep studies done. And that would be where you're actually videoed and you've got brain tracing and everything while you're asleep and see what's actually happening. Problem is, if it's only happening once a year, chances of them catching something.
It's like going to the dentist, your tooth never hurts. Or you go to a doctor or whatever it might be.
Very distressing, I have to say. It sounds awful, doesn't it?
That's the exact word. Very distressing. Mid-50s, clean a bit of health otherwise, but started happening about 10 years ago.
Strange one. In their 40s. I suppose weight would be one of the issues, or if the person is a smoker as well, it could affect the breathing. But generally, I think it's more likely that this is a sleep problem as opposed to a sleep apnea, because it would be much more common, it would be happening much more frequently for him if it was.
Okay. To a child issue, a child getting ear infections very frequently, is there something that can be done to prevent that?
Oh God, poor thing. Yeah, you can actually, if they're happening very frequently. What happens with kids is that they have very narrow little tubes from the back of their nose up into their middle ear. And when you have a head cold, you're snotty, and the snot goes up into the middle ear as well. And with kids, that can get blocked. So what you have is your middle ear has a constant level of blockage of snot, for better word, in there. And every time the child's exposed to a virus or any other infection, that will get angry and inflamed and cause pain in the ear. And it can be very distressing. They're really miserable, especially when they're asleep or lying down. So you'll have a child who's really upset at night in particular and pulling at the ear maybe. If they're happening very frequently, we do treat them with antibiotics most of the time because they actually respond to antibiotics. But if it's happening very frequently, what we do is we actually refer the child to ENT, ear, nose, throat, and they have a little surgical procedure where there's a tiny little thing called a grommet. It's a little ventilation tube that's put into the eardrum. So that's, okay, so you're putting it in from the outside in. And so the eardrum, you're making a hole in it, so the gunk, that snot that's in the middle ear, can come out.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it can't come out. It's stuck in the middle ear because the eardrum is blocking.
Is it a common procedure?
It's very common, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it helps hugely because even though the child has still been exposed to the viruses and potential infections, it never affects them so badly because the blockage and the pain doesn't happen. So it works very, very effectively. And the grommets then fall out after a period of time. Sometimes children need two or three different procedures for it done.
So if the antibiotics haven't been working, maybe that's...
No, even if the antibiotics have been working, it really is based on the frequency of the infections and how severely affected the child is.
Okay. So definitely one for the doctor. I might have to go further, I should say, as well. Yeah. Another one for you, Maura. After exercising the next day, I get very stiff and sore. My muscles, particularly my upper legs, it often prevents me from exercising again for a couple of days. Is there something I can do to ease the pain or stop it from occurring?
Well, it's normal to have a build-up of lactic acid in your muscles after you exercise and to be uncomfortable. But the thing is, when you are exercising on some sort of an exercise program, you should be building up your stamina and building up your ability to actually deal with that. So I'm wondering if that person is exercising very erratically maybe and not actually giving the muscles an opportunity to improve.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't happen every time. It can happen maybe the first time, you know, the first time you'd go for something after not doing it for a long time. Or even the second time. But after a while, you should actually, your muscle strength and ability and improvement performance should improve. So it shouldn't continuously happen. So you need to look at whether the exercise program is wrong, whether you're very erratic in your exercising. And if you're not, if you're doing everything correctly, then maybe you need to have it assessed to see is there something actually wrong with the muscles.
Maybe somebody who's going out every 2 or 3 weeks and there's a break between it. But if it's someone that's doing this regularly, there could be
issue. Something wrong. It's unlikely to be, but there may be something minor like an electrolyte issue. And maybe they need to be drinking some sort of an electrolyte drink before or after exercise. But I wouldn't go with that first off. I would actually look at the exercise program first.
Yeah.
Because
is it strange to have the pains in the upper legs?
Depends on what they're doing as well, you see. Like if you went off cycling and, you know, that's what you're doing, or if you're horse riding and hadn't done it for 2 months, God, of course you're going to be sore, you know. So it depends on what you're doing. If you're only doing gentle exercise and you're doing it on a very regular basis, then there could potentially be something wrong there. And I'd suggest talk to your doctor, have bloods done and see what's happening.
Okay. Another one more. I did a blood test with my local GP. He told me I have high blood sugar levels. He didn't seem too concerned but said he would keep an eye on it. Is there something I could do to lower my blood sugar levels?
Well, more importantly than him keeping an eye on it, you need to keep an eye on it. Because, you know, obviously when he's saying that he's not concerned yet, it's not diabetes yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have high fasting glucose levels, it means that you're pre-diabetic until proven otherwise. And you really need to be very, very careful with your diet. And you really need to have essentially a diabetic diet from now on, which is low sugar, first of all, low fat as well, low salt. And the problem is you cannot reverse diabetes really once it is fully established. You can manage it and you can do very, very well with it. Particularly if you're heavy and you lose weight, you can actually really get it under control. But now is the time that you can actually manage this so that you don't develop a problem that will need medication. So even though your doctor's kind of trying to reassure you and say, don't worry, we'll just repeat it in a few months and see how things are going, most important is that you go on your low sugar, low fat, low salt diet.
Okay. Are there symptoms though? Because as you can see, I'm pleasantly plump, as my late mother used to say, you're cuddly. I was often concerned about the whole diabetes thing. Are there other symptoms that might give you a clue that you're maybe pre-diabetic, as you call it?
To be honest, they're very few, which is a worry as well. You know, when people have diabetes as such, they tend to have excessive thirst. You tend to be excessively peeing. You pee a lot more. You can be very hungry and you can actually lose weight when you actually have established diabetes. But in a very bad way, and then there's all sorts of other complications. But you don't need to be getting there. Once you're there, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So the problem is you don't really know. There's very few symptoms as such. What you need to do is be aware of it. And, you know, if you're in a certain category where you have a little bit of weight on, especially if your blood pressure is a bit high and you're not exercising well, if your family history, you need to be on a very low sugar diet. You need to be on low refined carbohydrate diet as well. And, you know, just loads of information on the internet about it. And it's really, you need to be on essentially a diabetic diet.
But go for an annual checkup, I suppose.
Have your bloods done, have fasting bloods done as well. But if you're, you know, even if the bloods are okay, it doesn't mean it won't be okay next year. And it's too late once they go off. So you need to be doing the diet first.
Or the doctor twice a year, whatever it might be. I'm a 46-year-old lady with nodules on my joints, the joints of my fingers only, especially in my left, even though I'm right-handed. I take loads of dairy, but at certain times my fingers are very stiff and sore, ongoing for about 2 years. Any tips or advice? Just on the one hand.
She's 46, is it? Nodules, it does sound, and if they're stiff and sore, it sounds like an arthritis.
What are nodules, first of all?
They're just swellings. And usually they feel quite hard. Mm-hmm. And they're usually around the joints. So, you know, say here the knuckle and then the joint in the front as well. Depending on where they are, kind of gives an indication of what type of arthritis it is. But it does certainly sound like an arthritis. If it's only one hand, it tends to be more osteoarthritis, wear and tear, rather than rheumatoid, which is more sinister. Mm-hmm. It could have been it can also be from infection and other things as well. If it's going on a couple of years, worth having an X-ray and see what's going on, maybe having some bloods done to see if there's any autoimmune condition there. Otherwise, I mean, these nodules probably will not reverse. What you can use are anti-inflammatory gels and things to massage into the joints. They help enormously. But you need to establish that it's something that won't get significantly worse, really.
It's strange to have it just in the one limb, the one hand.
Yeah. Osteoarthritis can be just one side. And so obviously more sinister things can be one side too. But if it's in several fingers, I don't think it'd be anything like that. If that person said they're right-handed as well, did they?
It's in the left hand, but they are right-handed.
Yeah. But maybe there's something they repeatedly do with the left hand that, you know, but often osteoarthritis is about wear and tear, so you would imagine it would be with the hand that's more dominant, you know, the hand that you use more. I think she should go and have that checked just because she's young enough as well.
No harm to have it checked. Yeah. Okay. Mm. We'll take a quick break, Maura. We'll come back to more questions very shortly. Dr. Maura Finn from the Ennis Family Medical Centre. I'll get it out yet. 0861 800 964 as always is the text number.
If it matters to you, let us know. Contact us now. 1850 400 964 or email focus@clare.fm.
Very welcome back to the programme. 0861 800 964 is the text number, and I'm joined in studio by Dr. Maura Finn from the Ennis Family Medical Centre, and we're answering your medical queries. Maura, the next one for you. I have a dull ache in my lower back, but it's most painful when I get out of bed in the morning. I work in a cafe all day and would sometimes be lifting a number of plates, but I can't think of anything else that might be causing it. What can I do to alleviate the pain?
Well, lower back pain is most often mechanical and very, very common. Lifts and plates, lifting anything, you know, we're all supposed to, you know, about back hygiene, where how you lift is really important, bending your knees and make sure you never lift with a straight back or without a straight back, you know what I mean? It's very, very common, especially at night. Often people have pain when they go into bed and can't get comfortable. This person's probably okay until they wake up in the morning. That stiffness in the morning is very much related to arthritis as well and wear and tear. It may be the mattress though as well. Changing a mattress is an expensive thing to do, so I'm not suggesting that's the first protocol. But do think about that, whether the mattress is old and whether it's a bit too soft. Because if you're in a position where you're... you know, if the mattress is quite soft, you might actually be getting into a position at night that where you're comfortable, you're sleeping, but then when you stretch out, in fact, you feel it. Most often with arthritis or any mechanical thing, you stretch, you kind of move around for a few minutes and it settles down. And that would be normal. And that's usually not anything to be too worried about. But what you do is you exercise as much as you can. You make sure that you are eating well. Don't put on too much weight because that puts more pressure on your back. Be careful about what you're doing at work as well. Don't lift anything too heavy. Ask for help if you can. And... just maybe say to the people you work with as well, see if they have issues as well. Maybe there is something that can be done around lifting the plates.
Okay. This, I think, an unusual one. I suffer terribly from tonsillitis. I would have to go to the doctor a number of times a year with the same complaint that I always end up unable to eat or swallow due to the inflammation. Will getting my tonsil removed to fix the problem? I think years ago it was just a case of if you had tonsillitis, they whipped them out and that was the end of it.
They did years ago, but they're not so much anymore. Yeah. You would have to. The guidelines now is, I think, God, I need to be, I'm not entirely sure about this, but I think it's about 5 infections that require an antibiotic in a year. Now, it depends on your age as well, and but if that require an antibiotic. Now, this person doesn't say whether they have antibiotics every time, because you can have sore throats. Everybody gets sore throats, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have a tonsillitis, you know. But if you have more than 5 infections in a year that require an antibiotic, you can have, they will do surgery for you. Or if you have what's called a quinsy, which is an abscess in your tonsillar area, and that's very serious and you need to be admitted for it, they'll do a tonsillectomy as well. Yeah. But taking your tonsils out is not always the first answer, first protocol, because like I say, people get sore throats, but they're not always tonsils. Yeah. People get a pharyngitis very frequently, which is the back of the throat, it's behind the tonsils. You know, when you're exposed to any kind of a virus, the first places it hits are your nose and your throat. And your tonsils are your first line of defence. They're part of your immune system. So they will swell and get inflamed, but as part of your body's fighting ability. So it isn't necessarily the right thing to take the tonsils out.
No, there's no indication how old the person is here at all. But is it uncommon or is it common enough that you'd have your tonsils all your life?
Oh, well, most people have them all their lives, yeah. Oh.
Well, what butcher decided to
did you get yours out?
About 7 or 8, yeah.
Well, you see, maybe you had awful problems up to that age. And see, the times when it causes most problems are for young children. Usually beyond, most children under a year don't ever get tonsillitis. Yeah. Beyond a year, from a year until about 7, 8, 9, they get, some of them get awful problems. And then teenagers again tend to get it and get it quite severely. After that, it's rare. I occasionally get it, maybe once every 2 or 3 years. It's horrible, but never, thankfully, have had to consider having them out. Yeah. But there are so many different, you know, you can have sore throats, pharyngitis, so many different things that people will call a tonsillitis. Yeah. But a tonsillitis is when you have pus on your tonsils and they're swollen and you're toxic and you need an antibiotic. So it's a very different thing. And if that happens frequently, you do need to get them out.
Okay, since we don't know the age of the person involved or whether they are on antibiotics or have been on antibiotics, they might need to get it checked out.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there an effective way to prevent athlete's foot? I do a lot of running and play hurling and I get fungus fairly frequently.
This is so common, it really is. And a lot of the problem is shoes. It's the runners. It's kind of wearing the same shoes every day. You should always try and alternate shoes if you can. I know that, you know, that means you have to have at least 2 or 3 pairs, but you do need to, for teenagers in particular, you know. Athlete's foot is a fungal infection. It particularly affects in between the toes. It causes the skin to break down and get itchy and crusty, and it's quite miserable.
Yeah.
Now, it's not life-threatening, but it's horrible, you know. What I would suggest, always take your shoes off when you come home in the evening, shoes and socks off. Bathe your feet if you can, if you need to. Now, you may not have to do that every single day, but if you have a problem, this is what you need to do. Bathe your feet in warm water. Tea tree oil in the water is really, really good. It has natural antifungal in it. Make sure you dry them completely, pat them dry, and dry between the toes as well. But pat, don't rub, because you know, it'll make it sore. And then, you know, go around barefoot or with kind of very thin socks on or something like that, so that your feet don't get sweaty. It's sweat that makes this happen.
Okay.
And when you come home in the evening, like for a teenager, barefoot or flip-flops or something like that, let your toes out as much as you can. That person's playing hurling as well, so the football boots are probably really sweaty too. But the socks, the football socks as well, just make sure they're clean. Make sure you've aired them out in between. If they're playing every single day, I don't know. I mean, it's expensive to buy 2 pairs of boots, but I really think you should try and alternate your shoes if you can.
Is there a chance, I wonder, that someone has just thrown the socks into the bag and using the socks again the following
probably
day?
Probably. That is a big issue. And it may not even, the socks is a big issue, but it's the feet. More importantly, you really need to kind of keep the feet clean. And things like, there are powders and things you can use, and some people find them good, but generally I think it's far better just keep them dry and keep them aired. Powders tend to clump. If you have athlete's foot, a powder will clump around the inside of the toes and actually nearly make it worse. So it's just keep the feet as aired as you can. Don't wear socks in bed, things like that. You know, don't let them get sweaty.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
I recently scalded myself with hot water. It's very painful. What's the best thing to do with a burn to speed up the healing process?
Yeah, the thing about a burn is always, well, the most important thing with a burn is that it doesn't get infected, okay? Because what you're doing is you're actually stripping the top layer of skin.
Yeah.
So you're stripping your protection. What we use are things like Flamazine. There's these very strong creams that are protective and that help soothe the skin. You keep it clean and you keep it moisturised. And if it's got blistered, you don't burst it unless it looks like it, unless it's kind of so awkward that you have to. Because the important thing is you don't let the area get infected. So if it's a scald that isn't too bad, it's probably just if it hasn't needed to go and seek any extra help, it's probably not too severe. But what I would do is go into the chemist and get some Flamazine and just make sure it looks clean.
Yes.
That's the most important thing.
Just surprising that maybe this person didn't take more care of it sooner, possibly. Or maybe wasn't too concerned about
maybe
it.
Maybe
it got worse.
Well, if it did get worse, then it's probably because it's gotten infected. I'd worry about that. Like, a scald is most painful in its immediate, like straight away in the acute sense. So if it has happened a few days ago and they're now concerned about it, I would worry that there's an infection there. So I would get that checked. And you'll know an infection because the area is hot and maybe pussy and maybe seeping a little bit. And if you're unwell in any way, you'd need to get that checked.
Okay, the whole thing then, Maura, of people when they scald themselves, putting their hand under the cold tap.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Should do that, yes.
I heard different. Yeah.
No, you need to try and cool it down. Yeah. You need to try and kind of, because what's happening is the skin is inflamed and burning, so you're trying to kind of cool it. So it's the first thing you do. And it actually helps from a pain point of view as well. Then obviously you see what happens. What's the aftermath? Have you got skin that's been lifted off? Blisters. Have you got a blister? Yeah. Have you just got a red area? You know, it's painful, very painful thing as well.
What about
it happens so often with kids, you know, when you know, kettles and flexes and pots on that. You know, it does happen a fair bit still, unfortunately.
What about aloe vera? I got a gift of an aloe vera plant which went ape and ended up in 10 different pots eventually.
Yeah, they're brilliant.
I had one on the kitchen, the windowsill, and scalded myself, cut it off, chopped it, put the gel over it, worth a treat.
Perfect. But what you do is you put it under the cold tap first.
First, okay.
Because you want to stop the scalding process, you know. But aloe vera, is fabulous. Yeah. It really is for sunburn and stuff as well.
Pretty good.
Don't know if the products around it are as good, but the plant and you peel it or chop it and you squeeze it. Fabulous. I was in Sri Lanka once and it was just brilliant the way they...
And there's a load of gel in it.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
In any leaf at all.
They actually last forever, like the plants as well.
Yeah.
So,
I learned the hard way. One pot, 10 pots.
Yeah.
This is interesting, I think, and I'm sure you're asked this regularly as well, Maura. I've been trying to quit smoking for a number of years, but have never succeeded. I get very short-tempered and overeat as a replacement for cigarettes, but ultimately give them up each time. What would you suggest?
I feel so sorry for that person because they call this a cycle of you know, addiction and trying to get off something where people go through a cycle several different times before they actually achieve the goal of getting off whatever it is they're on, and particularly with cigarettes. The most important thing is that you need to be really motivated. It's the only thing that works. The only thing that really works is that you believe that you need to get off these. Then within that, there are so many different types of things that you can use, like nicotine replacement products. They have proven to increase your chance of quitting enormously. Then there's prescription products as well. There's quit.ie, which is a HSC service, and it's excellent. And they provide counselling one-on-one, they provide group counselling, and all these things give you all sorts of little tips and then also help and support, because that's what you need. I think the other really important thing is that when you decide to give up cigarettes, you need to have an alternative. Because most people smoke as a reward for something. You know, they smoke when they've come home from work. They smoke because the kids have been dropped to school and then they're having a cup of coffee, whatever it is. So it's the associations they make with why they're smoking. So when you've come home from work and you are not having a cigarette, what are you going to do? Are you going to be cross and just give out? Are you going to play a game on your phone? Are you going to read a magazine? Are you going to... Do you know, is there something else you can do that's a substitute, an alternative, and not the food alternative? Because that is a mistake a lot of people make. But you need to have it really well planned out, because otherwise you get so frustrated, you're so cranky, then, you know, and that's the time that you've always, when you're stressed, has always been the time that you've gone and reached for a cigarette.
Yes.
So it has to be very well planned out. And the quit.ie and some of these support groups would be very good for giving you tips that way. There are lots of medical interventions. They work.
Yeah.
So please keep that in mind as well. But the most important thing is that you need to be determined that this time you're going to do it.
It's a difficult road. I never smoke myself, but I know people who get them up like that.
Yeah, some people do, yeah.
They were told, I know one person who told by the doctor to give them up, and I laughed at them and they did. And that's an amazing thing to do. I know one person as well who has been off cigarettes 15 years, but still has the little plastic Nicorette cigarette thingy. Okay. 15 years later.
Yeah.
So it
we
can
see a
be
lot
a long
of that
process.
Is the habitual thing as well. Yes. It's the kind of the oral thing with cigarette as well.
Yes.
But it's really important to know that no matter what age you are, like you could be 80 and smoking, it is still going to be good for you to give them up, because they... the immediate, like within days, you have a huge improvement in your cardiovascular system, your respiratory system, your heart, your chances of stroke and heart attack reduce enormously very quickly. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people think, oh, you know, is it too late now at this stage? You know, it's never too late. And if you fail this time, try again.
Yeah. It's a difficult one. It's one of the
it's
most
very
difficult
hard.
Ones.
Yeah. It really is.
Maura, we have a few more questions which we'll hold for next week, if that's okay with you. Thank you so much for coming in, Dr. Maura Finn from the Ennis Family Medical Centre. 0861 800 964 is the text number for your comments. And if you have a query for the doctor, you can also email us on focus@clare.fm.
Clare FM's Morning Focus, the voice of the Banner County.